Good morning, everyone. Of course, this title is a complete bait and switch, just as an excuse to get people here early for reasons that will become clear. I think this is a very difficult question to answer. Before I get to it, just a word on who we are. We're a long-term research-driven investment firm. We run high-conviction benchmark agnostic portfolios. We're equity specialists with a 50-year history, although we really trace our roots back almost 70 years, have a proven discipline and a generational view of building wealth. We offer our services in whatever vehicle we think is most suits the end client. We tend to work primarily through advisors, RIAs, consultants, for reasons that I'll also explain. We have a single team, a single investment philosophy, but we structure essentially five different strategies based on market cap, geography, or sector. At a time when the conventional wisdom is all about passive and indexing, I think it's notable that all five of these strategies have in common the fact that they have outperformed their benchmarks and their peers since we started them over long periods of time. They're all high conviction, benchmark agnostic portfolios. They all have low costs, which is part of our culture. And in all of them, we are the largest investor or among the largest investors. We think alignment is an essential part of fiduciary duty. So we eat our own cooking. We put in our own money. The big news for us and the reason that we're here and that Nicholas was kind enough to invite us is because this January, we took three of our long-term proven strategies that we thought were particularly timely in this market and began offering them as ETFs, one based on our concentrated U.S. Large-cap approach, DUSA is the ticker for that, a true traditional ETF, DFNL based on our financial fund, which, by the way, I started our financial fund 26 years ago, actually 27 years ago now, and it's achieved terrific results both versus the financial indices but also has beaten the market. We think that's a particularly timely area. And then one based on our tremendous global strategy, which I can brag about because I don't run it. My partner, Danton Goey, we've been partners since 98. He's run our worldwide strategy with great success, and that's DWLD, Davis Worldwide. So we think these are proven strategies with long records of outperformance, and they won't be, they're the models for our ETFs. They aren't identical, but these are true traditional ETFs combined with true equity active management, and we think that's sort of a first in the business and in the market. So here was the question that I used to try to lure you in. Where's the market headed from here? And before I address it, I'm going to give you the quick McKinsey 2x2 box to point out that all the data that we're bombarded with every day really could be put into this grid, 2x2 grid, based on whether it's important or unimportant, knowable or unknowable. We'll try to avoid the box on the lower right, unimportant, unknowable. This box, which is unimportant but knowable, is really what we hear about on CNBC every day. This is, trying to come up with some rationale for why the market went down 0.2% yesterday or up 0.3%. It's quarterly earnings noise. It's just fluff, but it fills up a lot of airtime, takes a lot of ink, but is essentially knowable but unimportant. Of course, I vainly want to structure my remarks to be focused in this box, information that is both important and knowable. But before I get there, I want to spend some time on this last box. This is data that would be incredibly important if you could know the answer. However, it is inherently unknowable. And I would posit that it's in this quadrant that we spend most of our time in conversations with clients because people want to know the answers. They want predictions. And the only honest answer is we don't know and neither does anybody else. So let's start with our first question. Where's the market headed from here? Well, here's the prediction of the top Wall Street strategists going all the way back to 1999 for the outlook for the market 1 year hence. Their prediction is the orange line. The blue line is what actually happened. My high school junior daughter, an old classmate of Nicholas's, Nicholas's daughter is taking statistics this year, and the technical term is uncorrelated. How about the outlook for the economy, right? Galbraith said the function of economic forecasting is to make astrology look respectable. This is why the blue line is the outlook for GDP as compiled by the top forecasters. And the red line is what actually happened, year-to-year GDP growth, uncorrelated. My friend Bill Miller and I started putting this data together when we first met a long time ago. And we simply take the six-month prediction for interest rates that's printed in the Wall Street Journal, that is the forecast made by the top Wall Street strategists. We score it as correct if they get the direction right. Higher, lower, or the same, they're wrong 64% of the time. So we spend all this time trying to answer questions about when the Fed is going to move, when the economy is going to slow or overheat, what the market's going to do, and it's a complete waste of time. Of course, we do it because it's what clients want, but the fact is we can't know and nobody else can. So what if we can redirect the conversation towards what we can know? Right? There's a wonderful saying from Howard Marks, just because we can't predict doesn't mean we can't prepare. The first step of preparation is knowing where you are starting from, knowing where you are. So although we can't predict, we can understand our starting point. And based on that starting point, we can think about what the probabilities are looking forward. So let's think about what we talked about, what we can't know. What can we know? Well, we can know that stocks are very likely to outperform bonds over the next decade or two. And that's not a prediction based on when the Fed is going to move. It's simply starting with valuation, right? Relative valuation. Put bonds on the same footing as stocks, and you start at a 40 PE, a 40 PE for essentially an entity with zero growth, because what? It has a 2.5% yield. Stocks at less than half the valuation with a little bit of growth and a dividend that is almost the same. What else can we know, right? Well, we can know that market dips are inevitable, unpleasant but inevitable. This chart simply shows the drawdown from peak to trough each year in the S&P 500. The average drawdown is 14% from the peak of the market in a given year to the trough of the market in a given year. 57% of years have double-digit drawdowns. So knowing that, looking over history, I took this all the way back to 1928, right? We know that we should expect a 5% dip every 3 months. We should expect a 10% dip every 8 months. We should expect a 20% dip every 2.5 years. Now, what happens when we get that dip? Of course, the world goes absolutely crazy. Right, as if it's Armageddon. Now, of course, we've gone 7 years without a 20% dip. Now, I could have put this up 2 years ago and said we've gone 5 years without a dip. It is not a prediction that we're going to get one tomorrow or even this year. I have no idea. But what I know is that they are an inevitable part of the landscape. And all of this business of forecasting and then this overreaction to the dips is partly when you begin to understand the incentives of those involved. Right, so I'll give you a simple story from Charlie Munger, who I was asking him about. You know, I'm a capitalist. I think inefficiency gets wrung out of the markets. Why on earth do all these forecasters stay in business? And he said, well, I was buying a fishing lure in Minnesota at my lake house, and I said to the old timer, my God, it's pink and green, and do fish really take this lure? And the old timer behind the desk at the tackle shop said, mister, I don't sell to fish. Doesn't matter. I stock the lure because people take it. Now, the Weather Channel is not in the business of predicting the weather, right? They're in the business of selling ads. To sell ads, they need viewers. To have viewers, they need excitement. So we have to have a storm of the century every month, right? We have to have, you know, the heatinator or whatever they call the heat bubble. So you need excitement. And, of course, CNBC is no different. Simply saying, well, a 10% dip is expected, routine part of the landscape, will not fill up the airtime and sell ads. You need drama and excitement. So this inevitable part of the landscape will be hyped. Well, what else do we know? Well, this is why we built our business in conjunction with advisors. What we know is in all of this talk about expenses, with the idea of the fiduciary and DOL rules targeting expenses, that expenses are a sideshow. The biggest cost incurred by investors by far is their own behavior. This chart simply shows the 300 basis point spread between the returns of funds and the dollar-weighted returns that the fund investors got. Because, of course, they get in after market rises. They get in after periods of good performance. They get out after periods of bad performance. By the way, lest anybody is in the institutional space and feels smug, the data for hedge fund returns is significantly worse. 600 to 700 basis points, Harvard-Emory study, between dollar-weighted and time-weighted returns of hedge funds. It's also true in the institutional space. Watson Wyatt did a wonderful study on the hiring timing of hiring and firing that also shows about a 300-point spread. Well, when we think about fixed income, I'm going to dwell on that because I think there's some distortions in this market that persist from this low-rate environment. One behavioral one is I don't think people invested in government bonds, the end client, really understand in their guts that a 1% rise could wipe out 9% of their principal in a 10-year bond. My grandfather started in 1948. He called bond certificates of confiscation because what he heard from clients then is, you know, we went through a crash, we went through a depression, we went through a world war. We just don't want to take risk. We're not greedy. We'll take our 2.5%, which is what the bonds were yielding in 1948. We'll just take that and be happy. We just don't want to take risk. And, of course, they were wiped out. The purchasing power of a dollar in that period of time is down about 93%. 93%. So family fortunes were wiped out thinking they were taking no risk. Here's a distortion that's related. Top 25 dividend darlings, these are the widely held stocks of the dividend ETFs. This is a manic area of complete irrationality in my view. The stocks, those 25 stocks have $4 trillion of market cap. They're trading at 25 times earnings versus a market at 21. Over the last 5 years, their revenue has fallen 1.2% a year. Their payout ratios are up to 83%. They're burning the furniture. And they trade at those valuations because people are so happy to have some income. They're thinking, you know, you got to receive that 3% dividend for 33 years to break even. It's not going to happen. We're interested in income too, but we like it to be growing. I could spend the whole time on this slide. I'm going to go through it very, very quickly. But just to let you know that as you look around the world, understanding where you are, understanding the starting points, understanding the big risks, the big opportunities is key. So look in the U.S. Well, of course, we know these basic bullet points of the development of innovation versus the middle class, momentum versus valuation. The one I would highlight, particularly to index investors, is simply the risk of peak margins, the risk of peak margins. I mentioned those payout ratios. You know, corporate profit margins are at all-time highs. Companies, I do think, in many cases, are burning the furniture. In a low-growth world with high valuations, peak margins is incredibly dangerous. I think it's been a tailwind for the index. I think that's changing. I think selectivity is going to be key because I think earnings could really falter if margins falter. My partner, Danton, is living in Europe for the next 6 weeks. He tends to go around the world each summer with his family looking for places where there could be opportunity. He's in Europe now, and I would say that we do see some hope, some green shoots, but the simple fact is the demographic challenges, the regulatory environment are so pervasive and make it so hard to get things done. So within Europe, our focus tends to be, and we recommend a focus really on global leaders that happen to be headquartered there, rather than companies whose prospects are tied to hope for growth in Europe. And finally, emerging markets. I view this as a completely asinine category. It makes no sense. It's like talking about growth stocks, right? You can't be an expert in growth stocks. You have to look through at the underlying industries. There's so many differences between Russia and Brazil. The idea that somebody is an expert in emerging markets makes no sense. I think it's an area where it's very dangerous to be cap-weighted. By and large, the cap-weighted approach means you're grossly overweighted state-run enterprises, large financials, really the most toxic stuff in emerging markets. My partner, Danton, has added so much value in these growth areas by focusing first on specific countries and then second on specific companies, and to own companies like Tencent in China versus the big beer, brewing, or auto or finance companies. It's just the difference is measured in thousands of basis points, not hundreds of basis points. So huge dispersions. Active management, has everything been said? Well, of course, you know, dipping our toe into ETFs, we've learned a lot about this. We started in ETFs because our existing advisors asked, why couldn't we offer our services in an ETF form? After all, we're large cap, we're low turnover, we have a culture of transparency. Why couldn't we do that? And so our initial reason for doing ETFs was simply to serve our existing advisors, existing RIAs that were on platforms or had clients where the tax structure and so on were advantageous. What we have found increasingly is traditional ETF investors who are developing some more skepticism about the conventional belief that the index always outperforms are beginning to say, we should reserve a place in our portfolio for true active management. Well, you don't see it in the big numbers, of course, $1 trillion into passive, $1 trillion out of active. And the first question is, why bother? Why bother with active at all? Why is the opportunity to outperform so important? Well, the reason is because the power of compounding means a small advantage over a long period of time is life-changing. This just shows a 100 basis point difference over 30 years, resulting in more than a 50% difference in outcome. In our funds, whether it's our financial fund, our worldwide global effort, or in our core, the differences that have compounded versus the index can be measured in multiples as well. In our core fund, the difference is well more than 2 times the outcome for that small difference over time. So when I sit on an investment committee, I'll just give you another example here of the cycle of active versus passive. This shows the trailing 5-year returns of the S&P 500 and where it would rank relative to all managers, right? So when it's high, that means the S&P is outperforming and is near the highest level relative to active. When it's below the midpoint, it's underperforming. What this simply shows is that that's not a random distribution. There are periods of time when active does better. There are periods of time when passive does better. We are in a period of time near a peak in terms of passive's relative performance. This is what the underlying markets look like. Passive tends to outperform in periods of time when the index return is very high. Look at that shift to the left. And this is something that for passive and ETF investors has become more and more meaningful. They look at this idea of, well, in periods of time when the market doesn't gallop ahead, we notice that active tends to do better. And, of course, then the question is, well, what sort of active does better? And this is what I look for when I sit on investment committees. Low fees, different differentiation from the index, low turnover, the long-term orientation, the proper incentives and alignment of interests, experienced team, and a proven record. The fact is that higher active share alone, which is that differentiation from the index, correlates strongly with outperformance. What you can see here is when the active share is above 60% or so for an individual manager, they have tended to add value over the index. That's a very strong result. But here, I think, is an even stronger one. This study was done by Morningstar and our friends at Capital Group. And it simply says, let's take two obvious factors. If you are hiring a manager on behalf of a client, here are two obvious factors: low costs and alignment of interests. So what they did is they took all active managers and simply looked at the lowest quartile for fees and the highest quartile for insider ownership. And what they found out is that among that index, looking at all rolling 10-year periods, they outperformed 89% of all rolling 10-year periods, 76% of all rolling 5-year periods, not 55%, not 52%. This wasn't close. This wasn't close. It's amazing to think that 88% of all funds are run by a manager that doesn't have $1 million invested in their own fund. 88%, right? We don't own a single stock of a single company where the CEO doesn't have at least $1 million invested in that stock. So we do think that that matters greatly. So I'm going to end by just giving you a quick look at where we see opportunities with the market at a high, where we want to look. I'm not going to go through each of these categories in detail, but what I will do is dive in on the one that we think is the most timely. But first, this idea of global leaders at a bargain. This happens in a momentum market. You get some busted momentum and an opportunity to buy a company like United Technologies at 15 times earnings, you know, because people are worried about Otis in China or new jet engine platform. Those are terrific. I call that a value investor's dream. The contrary areas, the areas where people just don't want to own them, energy and financials. Today's disruptors are tomorrow's blue chips, you know, some obvious ones here, but they weren't so obvious years ago, and you could have put Charles Schwab in that category 15 or 20 years ago, disruptor that became a blue chip. And finally, this great advantage of a global platform is finding these national giants in developing markets. Naspers happens to be African, but of course, 105% of their market cap is represented in their ownership of 30% of one of the best companies in China, Tencent. That's a great example where the indexes create huge distortions. Who would think you could buy the best company in China at a discount if you own a South African company? But I'm going to dive very briefly into the particular area of the market that I think is the most interesting today. And the reason is I started our financial fund 27 years ago or so because everybody remembered the SNL crisis. People didn't want to own financials. There had been some recovery, but people didn't trust it. And so you really had 20 years of terrific performance. I think there's three ways to win in financials today. You've got earnings growth, you've got very low multiples, and you've got an increasing percentage of dividends and buybacks capital being returned to shareholders, unlike the dividend darlings. And I'll give you examples why. First question is always, oh, but these are fly-by-night companies. They can blink out of existence. Well, this is our 7 of our 10 largest holdings in our financial ETF, DFNL, and in our financial mutual fund, Davis Financial Fund. The reason I put that out is 7 of the 10 are in their second century in essentially the same business. I would challenge you to name another 7 companies that are in their second century doing the same thing that they started out to do. We could all name maybe 2 or 3, but we'd have a hard time with 7. Enormous durability. There's the earnings growth relative to the financial index, earnings growth since 2011. Remember I mentioned the payout ratio of the dividend darlings at 83%? Look at that payout ratio of banks, 25%. So you're getting 2% dividends already, but with a tiny payout ratio. This is how that looks in our portfolio. So this is actually DFNL. What it shows is, well, the dividends, you know, you want dividend income, you want dividend darlings, dividends only 1.8, 1.9%. And yet, look at that. You're getting more than 5% cash back every year through share repurchase combined with dividends. They're still retaining another 20% or so of their earnings, which means that they are generating, on average, 7.5% of their market cap each year. Each year. And because capital ratios have grown so high, I would posit that that is almost entirely distributable. So they will be the dividend growth stocks, I think, of the next decade. Valuation, just to give you a sense, look at that, a 27% discount to the market. So earnings growth, low multiples, rising dividends. However, having made this pitch for financials, the one thing and note that I would end on is this is an area to be selective in. right? You must be selective. I'll give you just, you know, our financial fund, the XLF, the biggest ETF in finance, I think started in 98 or 99. We've had twice the return of the XLF. And that's not true in every three-year, five-year period, but it is true over the long term, because what happens is the index gets more and more concentrated. You want an amazing number. You know, the financial index right now is invested almost 50% in five companies. Four of them are mega cap banks. So that is a very dangerous thing. And, you know, there was a period of time running our financial fund where we were beaten like mules by the Fidelity Select Home Finance Fund. I'll tell you, with a long history investing in the financial sector, that sort of micro concentration can be very dangerous. There's a huge dispersion of outcomes with financials. This simply shows 138% yearly difference between the best and the worst performing financials. So we think it's an area where there's a lot of opportunities, but we think it's an area to be relatively conservative once you commit to the area. We think there's a great danger of just throwing a dart. There are too many differences in the underlying business models. So with that, I will end. I'm very grateful to have been here, and I hope I've made a case both for active management, an outlook about a sense of what we can know and what we can't know about forecasts, and maybe something about why we think our actively managed ETFs can have a place in clients' portfolios. So thank you very much. Said there was a countdown timer that looked very severe, so that's why I bolted from the stage. But my time is yours, and I'd be glad to take some questions.
Can you talk about your view on the five tech companies that represent the most part of the return?
Yeah, it's funny. The question was about the FANG stocks, the top tech companies. 2 weeks ago, I visited Apple, Google, and Facebook. I was out in Silicon Valley, and I go out every 16 weeks or so. We're known as value investors, but this idea that somehow you shouldn't have a deep knowledge of that area is crazy. Knowing Google helped us avoid huge losses in our newspaper stocks that we owned in the 90s. I think what's so striking is that unlike 1999, most of those companies don't look dramatically overvalued to me. Netflix worries me the most. Apple is the company I think that could earn significantly less money 5 or 10 years from now, but it's at the lowest multiple. I started at a Japanese firm where we were big holders of Sony, and there's a lot about Apple that rhymes with Sony. You're selling a product that depreciates 1% a week, but people love it. It works well together. It's beautifully designed. But that price gap between an $800 iPhone and a $300 phone or a $100 phone, that gap is getting wide relative to the functions. So I would say that I wouldn't be uncomfortable owning that portfolio in aggregate. I think that there's so – but if you wanted one other thing to think about, the market cap of Facebook and Google is now roughly the size of the entire global advertising industry, right? So – if you take every billboard, every classified ad, every TV ad, every radio ad on earth, and you add it together, that's about the market cap of those companies. So you either have to believe that advertising is going to be redefined to the internet and be much larger, which is in fact possible because it's a much better medium, but I wouldn't bet that, or that those platforms will continue to evolve the way Google has, and that there'll be additional ways to earn money. But as I said, starting here, I would suggest that I think a company like I'm going to pick on General Mills. I have no knowledge, deep knowledge of General Mills at all. But just when I look at some of those dividend darlings with businesses that are shrinking 5 to 7% a year and are trading at 25 times earnings, and I look at Facebook trading at 25 or 27 times earnings, I'd rather own Facebook even with those caveats. So I don't think that's the big bubble yet. And that $4 trillion in the dividend darlings is a little bit of a bubble, but they're only overvalued by 30% or so. So it's not the 99 bubble. I don't think we're there yet. Yes?
Hi, thanks. Oh.
Most right-minded investors, there's a huge amount that I admire about Warren. And actually, we've been on a board together for 15 or 20 years at the Washington Post. And I've been Berkshire holders going back to my grandfather was on the board of Geico. I often think it's important to watch what he does rather than what he says. And so, of course, Berkshire was a big writer of certain derivative contracts. We have no direct derivatives exposure, of course. We don't do derivatives in our own portfolios. Our biggest indirect exposure is through our ownership of J.P. Morgan. I always say that in owning any complex financial institution, the CEO must have the capability, the temperament, and the knowledge to serve as the chief risk officer. I would suggest that really J.P. Morgan is the only one that really passes that test in terms of understanding. But I do think that is a reason, in a 20-stock portfolio and a 10-stock portfolio, I'm comfortable owning J.P. Morgan, but I would not want to own it in a 3-stock portfolio because of that long-term risk of that sort of systematic dislocation. Yes, Nicholas, and then we'll take it here maybe. Should I go here and then here? All right, yes. Hi. I figured I'd better take our host first, but he like a gentleman, deferred. No, he deferred to you.
Okay. My name is Susan Jeffrey. I'm an investment advisor. Are you able to go back a slide?
I think so. No.
Okay. On your disclosure page, did I see as of March 31st, were those the top 10 positions held in one of your funds? That was listed on there?
It well could have been, but of course you can, because we run these as fully transparent ETFs, you can look
My question is, I noticed there were over 40% was in 10 stocks. Is that generally the case in your...
Yes. In other words, we've done a lot of studies in the academic literature, but also just a lot of history as practitioners. And in a sense, what we're trying to do is get the benefits of diversification. And all of the academic literature makes it clear that, with about 20 positions, you capture the lion's share of the benefit of diversification with the important benefits of concentration, and especially in this market, selectivity. So, for example, our DWLD has about 40 positions. I think the MSCI ACWI has like 4,000. I mean, of course we should be able to beat that over time. The financial index is the only one that is sort of strange because it has this super concentration in 4 mega-cap banks, about 40% of the portfolio in those 4 companies. And that's one where even as a believer in concentration and focus, even I say, whoa, that's a little too much. Not because I don't like those institutions, but just because I think you have huge exposure to a single or one or two macroeconomic variables. And I think you lose the benefits of diversification in that. So our concentration tends to be in number of names, but you'll see a lot of industry diversification within those names. And in fact, even in financial, you'll see insurance and investment banking and asset managers and life insurance and health insurance, whereas in the financial index, you just see this concentration in mega cap banks. In our other funds, we'll manage it with industry spread. So we'll have Amazon and Berkshire Hathaway and United Technologies, reasonably large positions, but enormous diversification by subsector. So I hope that helps. Yes, Nicholas.
So looking ahead, I think you are very positive on the market.
Positive on the market?
Yeah.
Well, I'm certainly positive on the market relative to fixed income. I think the useful way to start as an investor is always to just invert the PE. That's your earnings yield. That's how we talk about it at our place. We view ourselves very much like private equity investors that don't use leverage, right? We look at each investment as if we were buying the whole business, and our return will be driven by the earnings yield, the earnings that the underlying investment generates. Just the way if we were buying an office building for $1 billion and it produced $50 million of income, we'd say, well, we're getting a 5% earnings yield. That's our starting yield. And if over time that grew to $70 million, we'd say, terrific. We're up to a 7% return on our investment. So we don't really look for that. We wouldn't take that office building and get it appraised every day. What could we liquidate this for? If we did, it would be hugely volatile. But the underlying business is relatively stable. So when I look at our portfolio today, we're at about a 6%, 6.5% earnings yield as a starting point. And we think that's not really a bad place to start in terms of thinking about return. So I think that's, and we think we can have 100 or 200 basis points over that. So we sort of, we model each business that we buy about how do we get to a 10% return over time. And if we're starting at 6 or 7, we think that's all right. Market's around 5. So I would say I'm not wildly bullish, but the idea that the market is grossly overvalued, I totally disagree with. But with the one caveat that there are a lot of margins that are overstated, particularly in some of the consumer and drug companies. So with that, thank you so much.